Welcome. We'd like to call the Joint Resources meeting to order, and contrary to popular belief, this is not a coup. The House has not taken over the Senate. With us today, members of the committee, Representative Seaton, Rosas, Kawasaki, Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, and Representative Newman, welcome at the table. Today, we're here for an overview of the mining industry and its effect on Alaska. We'd like to get started. Senator Green and Willekowski are in meetings and will be here shortly. With that, Mr. Burrell, would you like to come forward and start us down the path?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. On the screen, you'll have a set of slides to watch as we go through this. Today, what we thought we might do is I would share a summary of the current mines and projects, and then we've asked Jim Calvin of the McDowell Group. They developed a review of the benefits of the mining industry, and he'll be going through those. there are the two of us, our respective positions. And starting right off with placer mining, 2005 and estimated for 2007 and estimated for 2008, quite similar. More than 100 family mines operating around the state. Various others have permits in hand, and on a given year, if they can get their financing together to pay for the fuel they need and everything else, they'll be out operating. Production somewhere over 60,000 ounces a year. This picture is is an operation I visited this summer on the Seward Peninsula. This was the only bucket ladder dredge that operated in the state. Historically, in the Fairbanks district particularly and elsewhere, there were dredges of this style that operated, produced most of the gold for a lot of years. And this is the last one operating. It's a fairly small dredge. This is a family operation. They've been they're operating on private land, patented land there. They've been mining there since the early 50s, the Tweets. It's two cousins and their wives and one or two sons that work, and they have to fly their fuel in and everything. But anyway, that's the only bucket ladder dredge that operated this this past year. Another example of a placer mine and the kind of a size footprint that a small placer mine can have. That entire area on your left has been reclaimed, and it's in the process of being revegetated. You'll see the airstrip for the particular company there on the right side. They're current mining off picture. major projects around the state. The slide's a little bit dark, but just to give you a picture, the up in the Northwest Arctic, of course, Red Dog, that is not very clear. Does anyone have a pointer? I could. I don't have a pointer. You have one. Okay, there you go. Point. Thank you. We'll be going. Those are the projects that we'll be talking about, plus a couple other smaller ones. But we're talking projects. Mines and exploration projects all around the state, providing jobs all around. first, the operating mines, to walk through those. And these are in order of when they went into production. Usabelli Coal Mine is now in its 64th year of continuous operation. Second was Greens Creek, followed by Red Dog. They both began in 1989. Fort Knox began in 1995-96 time frame. Pogo in 2006 began, and there's one that has operated intermittently, Nixon Fork, out at McGrath, and it currently is idle, but we'll talk about that when we get there. Usabelli Coal Mine, the largest drag line in the state, a 35-yard drag line with you see the drill in the lower left-hand corner and the machine operating. Some statistics for Usabelli: 100 employees, 100% Alaska hire, 40 million tons of permitted reserves. That means they have permits in hand right now to mine 40 million tons of coal, and they're currently producing 1.5 million tons a year, of which 950,000 to the interior, for power plants, heating plants, et cetera. And then the another $350,000 to $500,000, depending on the year, to Chile and other export destinations. 270 days without a lost time accident, and various environmental reclamation awards over the years. Here's a here's a picture to show you. If you come down the road from the top underneath the word facilities, very good. I think we have a spotter. Here's the here is the shop and office complex. The mine is actually back here. You come hauling the coal. It comes up. It dumps into a large hopper in that region. Then the coal is crushed. It goes into a conveyor, comes across the Nanana River into this storage barn. And the railroad goes underneath that and is loaded out, and it goes to the customers in that fashion. Greens Creek Mine across 18 miles west of here on Admiralty Island. And at Greens Creek, so to give you some reference, that is the portal to go underground. That's where all of the ore comes out in large trucks. It the mining is probably taking place down here where this door is on the side, actually way below. But nonetheless, the ore all has to come out here. It crosses Greens Creek. Greens Creek runs right adjacent to the project, right through here. Literally, the bridge crosses Greens Creek, the ore stockpile. Here's the mill and the other other facilities. There's the power plant. Here's the shop office dry. Statistics, 315 employees, approximately 60% of those live in Juneau, 79% are somewhere in Alaska. Largest private sector employer in Southeast, largest taxpayer in the Juneau borough. More than $25 million annual wages and benefits, and more than $20 million in supplies and services. Here's a picture of a roof bolter, and to give perspective, let's see, right here, that's a man standing right there on that machine. We're talking large piece of equipment. This machine is just under $1 million right now for one of those drills, and I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess they have four of those at the mine site. Here's the loadout facility. You see the ore is brought by truck several miles down. It's dumped inside of this barn, kept in there. Out of the weather, it goes through a conveyor that's covered onto the ship, and then the ship goes wherever it needs to go around the world. Red Dog Mine on Nana Regional Corporation lands in the Northwest Arctic. The largest producer of zinc concentrate in the world, but yet a quite small mine as the size of mines go. The concentrate is hauled from the mine site 55 miles on this road. This is, I call it the Red Dog Port Site, but this is the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. That system is owned by ADA. It is operated by the company, by Tech Cominco, have their employees operating it. Here you see the largest building in the Arctic, and right behind it, barely visible, is the second largest building in the Arctic. The largest one is 225 feet wide by 1,500 feet long. Those are the storage buildings where the ore is brought. It's stored here across the winter, so it's hauled all the time, and then the ships can come in. The ships cannot, however, if you see on the screen, here's the loadout. The ships cannot get into that location, and so they're using a lightering system. There you see the barge, in this case a Foss barge, lighters the ore out to the ship in deep water several miles offshore. This was a beautiful day. It's not always quite that nice to go out into the Bering Sea. Red Dog statistics for 2007, 465 employees and full-time contractors. 56% of those people are Nana shareholders. $48 million in annual wages and benefits, $82 million with 13 different Nana joint venture contractors, including folks like that do the hauling of the concentrate from the mine site to the port that kind of thing. In 2008, one of the major projects that the company is going to have is a nearly a $9 million drilling program for natural gas. The cost of fuel in the villages of Alaska and, of course, in Red Dog and other mines is astronomical. It, the folks with Techcominco have been working for several years to find the gas, develop the gas resources that that they may have locally right there in their own areas. This picture shows the Akloch Extension Project. up here to give you a reference, we're looking, this arrow shows where north is, and so here is the here are the existing facilities, and this is the main pit. This is where they've been mining since 1989. This area right here, it looks large, but it's when you compare it to other large mines in the world, it is not a large a large pit. But and let me point out something here. This is the creek. This is Red Dog Creek, and I recall when this is a lined creek. I recall when this was built, it was $12 million to build that diversion ditch. It's a fully lined ditch. And the purpose of that is to take the fresh water that's falling off the map up on the hillsides and catch that water and bypass it around the mine site so it does not affect it at all by the lead and zinc and by any acid potential rock drainage. The project that's being permitted right now that they need, I think we're talking, you know, right around 2011, I believe the time period is. They need to be mining across Red Dog Creek in this Alloch deposit. That's where they'll go next, and that's it's some people would call it an expansion. It is not an expansion. It's an extension. It's just to keep for the mine to keep running right there and keep the jobs in place that are there at this point. a major issue for the people in the Northwest Arctic and for Techcominco and, for that matter, for all the companies is protecting subsistence lifestyle. Here you see we're looking from the west across this hill. There's the mill and the mine is in the background, but here's just an example of the caribou nonchalantly walking along eating close to the mine. One of the things that we would fully expect the legislature would be very interested in is the kind of local taxation that mines can provide. This is the no-tax school. This is the sixth school in the district in the Northwest Arctic that is under construction now. Five have been completed. And this is possible in part because Red Dog Mine is there. This school was at 250% of capacity before, and I don't think they're in the building yet, actually. But so here's a $40 million school that's being built at NOAATEC, in large part thanks to the fact that Red Dog Mine is in that district. And one last piece on Techcominco. When you see the gold medals and the silver medals and the bronze medals go to the Olympics in 2010, you need to know that there's Alaska medals in those medals that go around those guys' necks. And Techcominco, very exciting to see that they're going to be providing the medals for the Olympics. Fort Knox Mine, of course, at Fairbanks. In the picture, the actual mining area is over here. The main crusher is there, conveyor belt. This is the mill facility and the leach train, the tanks where the leaching takes place. This is the shop and office warehouse area. This is tailings impoundment. And up in this valley is where the heap leach has been permitted and is in construction right now. Statistics, 400 employees. No lost time accidents during the year, 38 million wages and benefits, 28 million for electricity. And I was reminded talking with someone this morning that the people in the Fairbanks, Representative Kawasaki, maybe you can is it still the case that it's still on their bills? It shows them how much they're saving because Red Dog's in place. At one time, that was on people's bill. That was showing, and it was like 7%, I believe, for a residential, yeah. And 10% for. So, the fact that Red Dog Mine was had a base load of electrical generation there, helped everybody in the community very, very directly in their pocketbook. Fuel cost about $15 million. Heap leach permits were received. The mine life extended to 2014. This is the same slide I had last year, with the exception that I added 2007, another year without a lost time accident, and we're talking 400 plus people. That's a significant milestone. A couple other things about Fort Knox. They poured their 4 millionth ounce of gold in January of 2008. Also in February, this last month, they were certified. There's a certification program, International Cyanide Management Code, and they were certified under that code this past year. A very significant milestone for the companies have to meet some international standards, and it is not an easy thing to do. And so we congratulate them for that. The heap leach facility is under construction at this point. Phase 7 of the open pit expansion is in place, with this year they expect an $84 million capital budget. Pogo underground mine, east of Delta Junction. In this picture, we're looking up the, this is the Good Pasture River coming by below. The original portal is over here. These numbers reference the elevation of the portals. The 1525 portal was the exploration portal. The road that comes from the Richardson Highway comes across. It crosses the Good Pasture River right down to this part down here. The actual Pogo Ridge, the mine is underneath this area. The gold mining is taking place. And then you have the conveyors that one of them comes out this portal. And there's the mill and the camp shop and those things. Over here on the sides, the airstrip. Quite compact mine site, but yet still covering quite a few acres. Here's an underground truck.
Before you go on, sure. I'd like to recognize Senator Wilkowski has been with us for a while. Representative Wilson and Book are also present, and I just wanted to put that on the record. So, Steve, if you go ahead.
Sure, thank you. Pogo statistics, 300 employees and contractors. 100 of those people are underground miners, specific job class underground miners. They achieved commercial production in April of 2007, and in 2007 they produced 260,000 ounces. That's compared with a budget. Their goal, if you will, was 340,000 ounces, but equipment problems and other things at the site, ground control issues, they didn't make it. Their forecast for this year is, again, 340,000 ounces. This is the water treatment plant. I recall, Carl, $6 million, was that what about the price? This one facility, a huge water treatment facility to process all the water before it's discharged. Nixon Fork, sorry for the darkness of the slide there. Nixon Fork is right now is not operating. It is idled. but during the first three quarters of 2007, it operated. They had 61 employees, 90% of which were Alaska hire, 20 additional contractor staff, and there's their payroll and supplies and services. They currently have 26 people on site. Their underground definition drilling to identify where the ore is. And in the picture, you can see the bottom of the airstrip in the center of the picture. That's just the departure end, basically. And then tailings impoundment, fully lined. Tailings impoundment is right here. Here's the mill site. The mine is actually right under that location, and here's the camp. Okay, mines that are under construction right now, and the reason we broke it out in this fashion is people hear these different names and they think, well, we've got all this mining going on. We only have five large mines in the state operating right now, but we have tremendous opportunity for the future. Two projects that are not yet in operation, but are under construction: Kensington, Core Alaska, just north of Juneau here, and Rock Creek at Nome. This is looking up Berners Bay. Haines is right off there. The actual valley where the facilities are located is right up here. Here's the port site where the people will come in, just like from Greens Creek. They'll come in on a boat, take a van up to the mine site, operate. There's what the facilities look like right now, and their construction is 100% complete for the mill and crusher buildings. They have it's a 15,400-foot tunnel that goes through the mountain over into the ore body and comes out on the Lynn Canal side. Underground mine workings are complete. They're in place. They're ready to go to work. The dock at Slate Creek Cove, which we saw on the previous slide, is in place. Ancillary facilities are all in place. These are the power units right here for the mill, the power plant units, and the actual portal is just back here, right in the shadow. one item remains, and that has to do with tailings placement. There are two approaches, two alternatives being followed at the same time. Permitting is in place right now. It has begun for a new tailings approach, but secondarily, an appeal is to the United States Supreme Court right now. There is no guarantee that the current permitting approach will indeed be successful, and so the company has no choice but to go ahead and appeal the decision of the Ninth Circuit to the Supreme Court. Permitting schedule needed to allow 2008 operations. Okay, January 2008, submitted the modified plan of operations. February, submitted other applications to Corps, EPA, State, and the City and Borough of Juneau. And then we hope by the end of this month to have a decision on NEPA direction that the project needs to take from the Forest Service, followed by a decision in April by EPA and the Corps to modify the existing permits, September authorizations to initiate construction, and October begin whatever the facilities are that are going to be required for the tailings construction then. That's what they very much hope the schedule will look like. Rock Creek Mill under construction at Nome. This is a picture that I took in August, was out there. They're just in the process of closing up the walls on the mill itself. Some statistics, 135 employees once they're in operation, an annual payroll. Think about this, an annual payroll of $10.4 million in a remote part of Alaska, 20.6 million annual supplies and services similarly. Okay, projects that are, we'll say, in advanced exploration or permitting. The advanced permitting alternative is Chuitna Coal. Pack Rim Coal is the company. This is right across from Cook Inlet. We'll see it in a slide. And then the advanced exploration projects, Donlin Creek, which is a Barrick Nova Gold joint venture, and Pebble Partnership, which is a Northern Dynasty Mines Anglo-American joint venture. Chuitna Coal Project, the last time I showed you this slide, they thought their investment was $450 million, and it's up to $600 million now. That is, I'm sure, a reflection of fuel costs in one case and steel, but the prices of coal, the price of metal are increasing, but the costs to mine are significantly increasing also. The mine will be a 12 million metric tons per year. That's what that means, 12 million, then MTPY, metric tons per year capacity. They have 300 million metric tons in this thing they call their logical mining unit number one. That's 300 million tons in that little block of area. Infrastructure, a 12-mile access road and conveyor, and on the map you can see here comes the road and conveyor down this way, 138 kV power line coming across, personnel housing and an airstrip, then down at the coast at Ladd Landing, a logistics center, export terminal, and a trestle about 10,000 feet long out into Cook Inlet to load Cape class vessels, meaning the largest vessels in the world, 60-foot draft. Just one thing here. Here's where their permitting is at the bottom. That long acronym stands for Alaska Surface Coal Mining Control and Reclamation Act permit. Okay, that's what that's long series is. Public review process. They project it for fourth quarter this year. Similarly, with the draft supplemental impact statement, I would have you recall that this project was permitted about 15 years ago. It went through an EIS, and so this is a supplemental to bring things up to current from where it was at that point. Projected approval late 2009. Donlin Creek, Chilista Lands, out in the Middle Kuskokwim. There you see the 150-man camp facility. The initial mining area would be right over in this vicinity. Donlin Creek update, 2007, 8 drills, completed 70,000 meters of drilling. 94% local hire, over 300 shareholders and descendants were employed at the project site. No lost time accidents, and again, that's a phenomenal kind of a thing to be able to say for a large, diverse project. Completed a draft feasibility study, and then, of course, during the year, NovaGold and Barrick formed Donlin Creek LLC, a joint venture. 2008, a major focus is looking at electrical power options. This is a huge, huge issue. Optimizing the feasibility study, the draft feasibility study, another 21,000 meters of drilling, hopefully completed by May. Optimizing plant design, mill, mine plan, facilities, et cetera, and continuing the environmental work, some of which has been ongoing, first began like in 10 years or so ago. This is an exciting drawing, exciting picture. It shows, and actually this shows the 2006 villages, 23 villages in the lower Kuskokwim, that were represented by people working at Donlin Creek in 2006. In 2007, they had 35 different villages represented in the area that worked at the project site. And I continue to come across people all around the state that are just so excited to have a major mining project like this in an area where there are so few jobs, so few private sector jobs. This has just been a tremendous, tremendous thing for the area. Pebble Project. This is one of the large drills that'll drill to 6,500 feet. This is incredible drilling operation that's ongoing right now. Investment to date over $220 million. $87 million of that have been on environmental and socioeconomic studies. In 2007, approximately 700 individuals, 50 consultants active, 80%, more than 84% Alaska hire, 150 residents of 16 different villages throughout the Bristol Bay region have worked at the project site. I'm not sure what the number is today, but I know they're ramping up to even more. In 2008, and first off, let's see, I don't see a number from last year, but I recall the number was $87 million was the capital expense last year. This year we're looking at $125 million for that project. That's their forecast. 10 drills drilling to those 6,000-foot depths, many of them ongoing environmental, social, economic, and of course, the Pebble Fund that has just been announced here recently. Okay, I want to touch on three other projects real briefly that we'll call early stage exploration. And one of the things that Jim Calvin will talk about when he follows me is there were 29 projects in Alaska that spent over $1 million each last year. That is a significant increase. I believe it was 23 projects last year, and before that it was, in 2006, 23 or something, and then tapering off beyond that. Three of the projects I'd have you look at, Niblack, Full Metal Minerals, and International Tower Hill Mines. These are not unique, but these are the biggest ones, if you will, of those that are right now in this category of grassroots. This is Niblack, which is right across on South Prince of Wales Island. What you see in the picture, you see a cross section of the mountain. This Lookout Mountain, for years it's been drilled, and they've spent $20 million since 2005 here, but they've had to set their helicopters, bringing their people up, and then drill to get down into these areas from clear on top. And so it's very, very difficult, drilling a lot of much farther distances of drilling than what you would like to do. And so this year, what they began, well, they began it last year actually, they collared a portal right here, and they are driving a 5,000 foot adit into this zone, and each of these places, at various places along here, they'll set up a drill station, and then from that location, then they'll drill up and down and off into the ore zones to see, explore it, to see what it's like. The real exciting project. This is potentially another Greens Creek style of mine. Now, is it big enough? Is there enough ore there for it to be economic? The company believes it makes enough sense to continue at this point, but it's exciting to think that we might eventually have another Greens Creek, and especially in support of the people and the pain that the people of Ketchikan have gone through over the years. It is incredible to see a significant potential development there. This year, they're looking at $15 million, 35 work crew on site. They'll be drilling underground throughout the year. Another company to tell you about a little bit is Full Metal Minerals. Full Metal has 11 project areas around the state. This year, they project having 8 drill programs. They have budgeted $17 million. Into those locations. I've listed on the page, it lists out all the different projects around the state. You can see their names, but I'd highlight one of them called the 40 Mile. The 40 Mile, it's on Doyon lands. They expect this year 15,000 meters of drilling. The budget for that project out of the $17 million, for that project alone is $6.5 million. 24 to 30 workers, depending. It's on Doyon land, and within the 40-mile area, if you will, that area, and I'm talking an area maybe 20 miles long by 5 miles wide. They have 7 prospects that they're going to be drilling on in that area. International Tower Hill, another junior mining company. Spending a lot of money in Alaska in 2007, 75% Alaska hire, over $4.5 million was spent with Alaska companies. They paid state and other landowners $577,000, and you'll note that in 2008 they are looking at 10 prospect areas. That includes some mental health trust lands. Some of them are on state claims. Some of them are on private native and other private lands. And budgeted this year at Live and Good alone. If you look in the picture upper left, this is the Dalton Highway coming past. And so in a state with so little infrastructure, to find an ore deposit that close and it's hard to see it on here, but this is the area that's highlighted over here on the map. This map area is right there. And to find a potential project site so close to infrastructure is just tremendous. And so we're very optimistic, very hopeful that becomes the case. They believe this looks something like a Fort Knox type of mineralization. So if that can be made economic, that's great. And over this is a geologic map showing the two primary target areas that they have, and they're budgeting the $7.5 million for Live and Good this year. With that, I will turn this over to Jim Calvin of McDowell Group, and afterwards I and others will be very willing to answer any questions you have.
Before you go, are there any questions
come
to mind before we get started? Representative Seaton? Before you go, I'd like to recognize that Senator Thomas has been with us for quite some time. So go ahead, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On one of your initial slides, I believe there was a mine, Two Bull Ridge. Yeah. Where is that located? I didn't see that on any of the other slides.
Two Bull Ridge is the current mining area at Usabelli. Okay. They had Poker Flats was where they're finishing up their reclamation now. And then on the north side of the main haul road is this thing called Two Bull Ridge. As a matter of fact, I have a picture, a painting of called One Bull on Two Bull Ridge. It's a big old bull moose, and you can see the drag line in the distance. A local artist had put that together.
And follow up. And that's an extension on the coal deposit. That's not a mineralized. That's coal.
Through the chair, yes, sir. It's all coal. That's what Usabelli does.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burrell. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Newman, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, there's discussion every once in a while about the mining industry and how they don't pay a lot of production tax. I guess I'm going to say that for lack of other terms. But isn't that due to the fact that a lot of mines are not on state land, that they're on private or native or mental health?
Well,
I know they pay a considerable amount.
Representative Newman, through the chair, this is exactly what Mr. Calvin is going to be talking about, and I would agree with you. We right now, for example, we have one coal mine on state land, and we have one gold mine on state land. Okay, gold mine is Pogo. We have one gold mine that's on mental health trust lands, which is a type of state land. But first off, we only have five large mines. And as you'll see from the work that McDowell put together, they're paying a huge amount, and we're pleased with that. We love to see that, and that's very, very good. But you're correct in part, but the biggest issue of all is we are in a state that has a tremendous mineral endowment. We should have 55 mines now, not five big mines. We should have 55. We should have mines in every corner of this state. And I fully believe that within 50 miles of every village, every hamlet, there should be some kind of a mineral. It may be rock, it may be gravel, it may be peat, but there has to be something that could be mined and providing local jobs for the people in those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski. Thank you. I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Thought I'd ask your opinion. Seeing all these TV ads now about how the some of the initiatives that are on for next year are going to stop the mining industry, and I'd just be curious to get your take on.
Yes,
on this.
Absolutely. Yes, the initiative will stop mining in new mines, and it will stop Red Dog. I don't care what some carpetbagger from Arizona has to say about it. It will stop Red Dog.
Can you explain how?
I'll tell you what. I'll have Carl Hahnemann do that, if I might. You want to do that right now, Carl? Mr. Chairman?
That would be fine.
Okay.
I think it's an important question. I think it's one that's on everyone's mind.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Carl Hahnemann. We're very concerned about the effect of these initiatives on the industry, including Red Dog. And for example, Steve mentioned to you and showed this slide that showed the Akaluk deposit, which is currently in the permitting process. It's also it's adjacent to the existing Red Dog Creek. And so the initiatives, for example, preclude the storage of waste rock in proximity to a creek. That's just impossible to meet that prohibition of the initiatives, and the initiatives would prohibit discharge of water, even tap water that's safe to drink, because of an outright prohibition of any discharge. So those are just very drastic, extreme measures that we would not be able to comply with. And looking forward, the you know, Red Dog is in this permitting process. We'll need new permits. We'll need expansion of the existing facilities. The initiatives clearly would apply to projects that need new facilities, expansion of existing facilities, and we don't have all our permits. So we're very concerned it would result in a shutdown, ultimately, of the project.
Thank you.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. Carl, for to expand on that a little bit, don't all of the current mines that exist have to go through a re-permitting process every 3 or 5 years, or any time there's a modification in the plan that was originally submitted, doesn't that require additional permitting?
That's correct. In fact, you know, that's part of the state of Alaska permitting system, is to have short time periods, 5 years. Every 5 years you have to go through a renewal process, including independent third-party audits, to look at the permitting and the operation of the project. And so that's why we're very concerned that the initiatives would apply to all new projects, existing projects.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suggested to several people last night, Carl, that what we do here is we have a sectional analysis of a bill that kind of explains what the bill is attempting to do. And I suggested that maybe such a similar document, short form, of the initiative would be helpful, because you hear one side says one thing, the other side says another. So I think that would be helpful for people to be able to make reference to a specific area of the initiative where we talk about particular clean water and what it is there. So someone would have a little more knowledge when you talk to people about that's not accurate, or it is accurate, and this is why, this is what will happen. There is, you know, everybody has to, as Representative Rosa says, new permits for, if nothing else, expansion. So when you do that, you're obviously going to be having to fall with under that, underneath the initiative, if in fact it passes, and that type of thing, just to make sure that people do understand and have better information. I think would be helpful, at least would be for me.
Well, that's probably a good suggestion. You know, we might be able to use information from the judge's recent decision, who happened to agree that these are improper appropriation of state resources, would result in shutdown of the industry, found it unconstitutional. Now, we understand that that has to be ultimately affirmed by the, you know, state Supreme Court, and we're still at risk in the interim. So we have to follow your suggestion and get good information out there about the drastic effect of these initiatives.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Just for some clarification, am I understanding that that you don't feel that there's any difference in the effect of the Clean Water 1 initiative and the Clean Water 3 initiative, that they both have the same effect on your mine or on mining in Alaska?
No, I think they're very different, and the judge interpreted them in such a way that he interprets them to be very different. The plain meaning of them were both to prevent and have provide prohibitions against storage of waste rock and other things, and so we are very concerned that if they are interpreted in accordance with their plain meaning to prevent, that they would result in a shutdown. Now, the judge has interpreted that it means adversely affect, and so we're studying that opinion, trying to determine ultimately what that means if it were to be passed.
Thank you.
Any additional questions while we have Representative Roses?
I'm not sure if Carl's wanted to ask the question of, but we saw in the slides in the presentation that the Greens Creek mine is right next to a creek. We also saw where the Red Dog mine is next to a creek. These are ongoing mines. What's the history of these two mines in terms of contamination of the water around the site?
And certainly you may not be the person to answer that. You know, you do have your own interests, so if you want to defer that, I certainly you know, you certainly may, but I think it is an important question.
Well, the history certainly at Red Dog is that it's well recognized that the water quality of Red Dog Creek now is much improved over what it was prior to the mine being there. Now, with respect to Greens Creek, I'm not personally familiar with that, but I would say that their record is exemplary with respect to Greens Creek itself.
Additional questions? Jim, I think you're on.
Thank you. My name is Jim Calvin. I'm a principal with the McDowell Group. The McDowell Group is a research and consulting firm. Been in business here in Alaska since 1972. I'd first like to express my appreciation for the invitation to speak here today. For those of us that study economic conditions in rural Alaska, all over Alaska for that matter, this is a particularly interesting and exciting time with respect to the mining industry, and I'm delighted to have a chance to share with you some of what we've learned with our most recent work in this area. You may be familiar with our initial study, a comprehensive assessment of the economic impact of the mining industry in Alaska, which was completed in 2005 and focused mostly on 2004 impacts. Since then, we've been asked to update some key points of that, and I believe you have a brochure that presents some of the findings of our update. And today I'm going to very briefly point to some of the more interesting aspects of the economic impacts of the mining industry in the state. We'll start with some employment impacts. Now, Steve gave you a great deal of detail on individual projects. What I'd like to do is roll it all up and talk to you about what it means in terms of overall economic impacts. We can point to 3,500 jobs in the state that are directly attributable to mining industry activity. Now, this includes jobs that are created in the mines that Steve described to you. It also includes jobs associated with about $275 million worth of exploration activity statewide last year, about $275 million worth of mine development activity last year. Also includes jobs associated with industrial minerals development, which of course is integral to all construction activity in the state. So that's just the direct employment in the industry. If you consider all of the multiplier effects of that activity, all of the indirect and induced impacts, we can point to about 5,500 jobs statewide that are related to Alaska's mining industry. Those jobs generate an estimated total of about $340 million in annual payroll. All of these numbers are about 20 to 25% higher than where they were in 2004, at the time of our last study. Also, I think particularly noteworthy to indicate that the average annual salary in the mining industry is about $80,000 a year, which is about twice the statewide average for the economy overall. Mining industry generates the highest average wages in the state, right behind the oil and gas industry. With this, don't want you to focus too much on the details on this image. What this shows, though, is the geographic distribution of the employment associated with the mining industry. These are the hometowns of people that are employed in various mining projects, exploration projects, development projects around the state. Clearly, it's broadly distributed all across the state. In fact, there's 120 different communities that have folks living in them that are employed in the mining industry. I should also add that if we were to overlay on this all of the people that benefit from royalty payments that are shared via the 7i provision of ANCSA, you'd have virtually every community in the state seeing some financial benefit associated with mining industry activity in Alaska. I think this was certainly the most interesting finding from our update of our earlier study. This basically summarizes state and local revenues stemming from mining activity in Alaska. In 2004, we could identify roughly $25 million in state taxes, fees, and local property taxes that were directly related to mining industry activity. Well, our latest estimates for calendar year 2007 suggest it's now up to about $185 million. The largest increase in this area has come in mining license taxes and corporate income taxes paid by mining companies. Talk a little bit in some little bit more detail about these. Let's first look at some of the local government impacts. Steve alluded to a few of these numbers in his presentation, but the point is that the mining industry is a critical source of tax revenue for several jurisdictions around Alaska, not the least of which is the Northwest Arctic Borough, which last year took in about $9 million in payment in lieu of taxes from Red Dog mine operations. The Fairbanks North Star Borough enjoys about $3 million in taxes from Fort Knox mine operations. Fort Knox is either the first or second, I think currently the second largest property taxpayer in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The city and borough of Juneau benefits from about $1 million in annual property tax payments from the Greens Creek mine. Greens Creek is currently Juneau's single largest property taxpayer. Once Kensington is up and running, hopefully this time next year, they will assume the position as the single largest property taxpayer in Juneau, and Juneau's top two payers of property taxes will be mining operations. Now, there are a range of other instances where the mining industry contributes to local government coffers, including a $500,000 payment in lieu of taxes to the city of Delta Junction from the Pogo operation. Payments to state government. This is where the big increase has been since our last assessment, and now totaling about $175 million. That includes $85 million in mining license taxes, a huge increase over the last few years, $80 million in corporate income taxes, $8 million in various rents and royalties, a couple million dollars in other various fees, payments, taxes. As we stand today, the mining industry is the second largest contributor of revenues to state government, behind the oil industry, of course, but above tourism, above the seafood industry. Also should note that the mining industry accounts for about $15 million in revenue for the Alaska Railroad. That's about 16% of the Alaska Railroad's total freight-related revenues. And as Steve indicated, there is mining activity on Mental Health Trust lands, and last year that generated about $1 million in revenues for the Mental Health Trust. Finally, I'll talk briefly about some of the rural and native corporation benefits. I indicated earlier that there's substantial ANCSA Corporation royalties distributed statewide. Early estimates suggest that total royalties paid to NANA, the owners of the property at Red Dog, will be in the neighborhood of $170 million. Now, what's interesting about that is, as a result of the 7i provisions of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, 70% of that money is distributed to amongst the 12 regional corporations. That money then is further, according to 7j provisions of ANCSA, distributed to village corporations. So here's a mineral industry revenue generated in the far northwest of Alaska that literally is flowing to every corner of Alaska. And some of this money is really a critical source of revenue for village corporations. Again, Steve alluded to some how important employment opportunities are for rural residents of Alaska. We'll point to a couple examples here that over half of the 465 jobs at Red Dog are held by NANA shareholders. 90% of the 200 jobs at Donlin Creek are held by Calista shareholders. Most recently here in Juneau, over half of the construction labor force at the Kensington project were Native affiliated. So important source of jobs and income for rural residents, Native corporations, and their shareholders. So take home points from all of this, dramatic increase in state revenues recently associated with mining license taxes and corporate income taxes. Mining industry continues to play and playing an even more important part in several local jurisdictions in terms of property tax generation. The industry is growing in terms of its employment impact. And finally, the economic impact, both in terms of employment and royalty sharing, is virtually every corner of the state. And that's it, and would be happy to answer questions if you might have any. Thank you.
Jim, I noticed that when we had some studies done by the university on capital investment and the number of jobs it created, I think the number was for every $100 million in capital, it generated 60 to 70 jobs throughout the economy. And if I, just from kind of working the math, it looks like the mining industry may be above that average. You know, if there's more jobs per capita than there is in the average. So do you have a...
Oh, I think so, Mr. Chair, yes, I think so. The, for example, the Kensington Mine will invest $200 million, and it's over $200 million in its project. That's Core Alaska. That'll generate directly 200 jobs. We've calculated the total direct and indirect employment impacts will be in the neighborhood of 370 jobs. That's one example that suggests that there's, in terms of investment dollars, there's a pretty high return on in terms of employment. That's the one of the interesting things about the mining industry is it's labor intensive. It has very, very high wages, and it's capital intensive, which means it generates pretty significant property tax revenues for those jurisdictions that are immediately affected by it.
Any questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelvin, you talked about $340 million in payroll, $170 million in royalty, like to Nanocorp. What type of economic multipliers can we assume off of these funds? And could you distinguish, does it change in different areas of the state, you know, and how many times that dollar rolls over?
It certainly does. There are varying multipliers for different industries and for different parts of the state. A mining industry payroll dollar spent in Kotzebue has a lower multiplier effect just because there simply aren't the services and supplies available there that you would have in Anchorage, for example. So as we speak, we're assessing the economic impacts of Red Dog royalties on the state and on Kotzebue and the Northwest Arctic Borough in particular as part of the Aqualuck EIS project, and there certainly are different multipliers depending on where in the state you are. And there are different multipliers. There's spending and then there's spending. Payroll spending almost immediately for Alaska resident employees of the industry, that's pumped almost immediately right back into the economy. Now, spending on goods and services might be different. For example, if you're buying equipment to support a mine, that may not have quite the multiplier effect because none of the equipment that operates in a mine is manufactured in Alaska, so that has a different multiplier effect.
Follow up?
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we could consider like the 2 to 4 or somewhere in there as a multiplier, or 3, or how would we, overall?
Through the chair, it varies from about 1.5, that is for in rural parts of Alaska, you might find for every job that's created by the mining industry, there's another half of a job, so 3 jobs for every 2, if you want to look at it that way. In more urbanized parts of the state or an overall statewide economic impact, you could be up at around 2 jobs, 2 and a quarter jobs. We really don't see multipliers in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 because we don't manufacture the explosives here. We don't manufacture the drill steel. We don't manufacture the heavy equipment that's required to operate a mine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Roses.
Thank you, and I appreciate the numbers you gave us on, you know, the cost for goods and services, but a question I would have is I know several of the mines in different areas contribute a considerable amount of money towards workforce development training to try to have some of these vocational centers and training centers that they help contribute money to try to grow their own, so to speak. Where do you include that in this? Is that part of the goods and services?
That's captured in some in our yes. In short, what's not captured, however, is the sort of the longer term benefit that those training opportunities have provided. There's exploration projects may come and go, but the skills that local people learn to participate in those in construction projects or exploration projects are skills that transfer to other industries. Construction, for example, it's very difficult for us to understand how many people really have benefited in that indirect way from at one point being employed in the mining industry, but we certainly know anecdotally that there are a lot of folks that are now employed in construction or oil and gas, for example, that learn their skills through mining related training.
Follow up, Roses.
Thank you. It would be kind of nice if somewhere in your data that you've collected, if you could break some of that out, because we spend and I know Representative Newman is really involved in a lot of this with some of the stuff he's doing, but we spend a tremendous amount of money and time and energy and effort on this workforce development, especially as we look forward to the gas pipeline and a lot of the training that's going on. So for us, it would be helpful if we had a breakout as to the amount of money that's being spent and the number of people that are being employed, whether or not they end up in the industry or not, at least the portion and the percentages that is being contributed to through the mining industry, because it has a direct impact on, as you say, on other areas in the state. But it'd be nice if we could isolate a portion of that so we can compare it to other industries and what they do or don't contribute towards growing their own, so to speak.
Through the chair, yes, I think that's a great idea. In addition to that, those kinds of benefits, contributions made by mining companies to various nonprofit social services organizations are very important as well. We're learning a great deal about these kinds of benefits through our work on Greens Creek and Red Dog, and it's quite interesting. What you don't see when you look at the, we can point to the 5,500 jobs in the state. What you don't see is the sort of the diversity of where mining-related contributions or spending goes, but they do filter through virtually the entire economy, from construction to healthcare to social services. It's a little hard to measure at that level of detail, but it's clearly there.
Any additional questions? One thing, and I know, Jim, you don't answer to us, you answer to the mining industry. They pay your bills, so I will ask some of those guys to answer those questions, see if maybe they can direct that in your direction so that it comes from your direct employer as opposed to us. So if you just kind of take note, that'd be something very interesting that I think we're spending a lot of time on workforce development, and anything we don't have to pay for, I think, is a good thing. So come ahead. Any other questions for Jim before he's done, and then Steve, maybe we could wrap up. And before we do, and maybe you're not the person to ask, and Senator Wilkowski left, but I want to follow up on the initiative process. Can you tell me, if you were to measure the impact on, say, Red Dog and I think Pebble, which I think is who the initiative is targeted at, is it going to have more effect on Red Dog, or is it going to affect Pebble, who's still, in my understanding, quite a ways from actually looking for that type of permit? So will it be equal across the board, or will it have more effect on the existing mines than the new projects? Can you kind of walk me through what your take is on what that initiative process would do, depending on the age and development of a mine, or would it just stop everything?
Yeah, my read is it's a shutdown, period.
Would you identify yourself? Because I'm not sure.
Steve Burrell, Alaska Miners. No, it's a shutdown. It'll shut them both down. I don't really have any question about that.
Carl?
Yeah.
So Pebble is in the process of using water and discharging water now that would prohibit it from.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the real issue isn't water. Okay, this is part of the deception of these initiatives. These are not about water. These are about stopping mining, and as Carl delineated a while ago, you can stop it by not allowing waste rock to be put within 1,000 feet of any stream. That would shut down several of the mines we've just seen the pictures of. You can do it by total disturbance area. If it's over 640 acres, broken record. You can't do that, and that'll affect small placers also, small family mines in some cases. And so it's not really water. It's far more than that.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Do you have something in wrap up, Steve? Or you?
Well, not really to wrap up, but Mr. Chairman, as a response to the workforce development questions, I'd point out that those 300 people in the Kuskokwim region that are now working and have been working the last couple of years at Donlin Creek, many of those people were trained by the company on site or in their villages to be drill helpers, to do different work at the site. And the same exact thing has been taking place in Southwest Alaska in preparation for the additional drills at Pebble. These are local people who are being trained locally The companies have brought in the drilling companies. They have brought in Mining Petroleum Training Service from University of Alaska, and they provided training programs locally right there. And one aspect that has not come out, has not come out today, is that if you're working at a mine project, you're going to be drug-free, or you're not going to be there. The companies absolutely have a no-drug and alcohol policy. You saw the picture of the shovel and the truck from Fort Knox. The liability for a company if they did not have an exact no-drug policy would be so great the company would close its doors. Because if you put someone on a machine like that and you haven't done everything possible to ensure that they're drug-free, and they have an accident and run off into a van of tourists that are coming out to see the mine site, the liability is so huge. Companies will not allow drug activity. And that's an aspect. A friend of mine, I won't say where it was in the state, but called and said, boy, such and such a program's having a company is having a lot of impact in our area. I said, oh yeah, they got paychecks. And he said, no. He said, the people in the different towns, they come home, they have to be drug free. And the children in the village look and say, huh, take drugs, can't get a job. I mean, how much money has this state and the federal government thrown at young people to tell them they need to stay drug-free? And this is doing it. So anyway, collateral benefits that we did not see coming at all, but it's huge. So
thank you. And I for one have always thought that the best way to keep people productive citizens and off drugs is through employment and having some reason to get up in the morning. So I agree with that, but also appreciate the drug policy as well. Representative Seaton, did you have a question?
I just had one follow-up. I really appreciate the information on the increased royalties and mining license fees and all. That's really good information. Do we have any information on the value of the minerals like a Red Dog or anything that's available to us?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, the state annual report gives the total value of the minerals that have been produced. Now, in that report, the assumption is that is a zinc bar, and it doesn't leave Alaska, for example, as a zinc bar. The gold does not leave Alaska as a 0.999% pure. So there's additional processing that takes place on these things, but it's the assumption that if the market value of this commodity in the world, the average market value for that period of time, it's like fish. Okay, what do they sell for at in Seattle? Is that what the fisherman gets? Yeah, the fisherman doesn't get what the price is in the store. He gets something significantly less, and that's the number. And that's the only number we have to work with. But the state of Alaska provides that in their annual report.
So I want to clarify that. So when we say there's X number of dollars of processing of gold in the state, that's a finished bar process. That doesn't include the processing to get it to that standard. So that's the value that they look at?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the state report, I don't know what it is, it's 62 or something like that, that between the DNR and Department of Commerce put together. That report lists three components of value. It's a measure. The first one is how much money did the companies take out of their pocket and spend to do exploration work. So that's the exploration piece. The second is called development, and that's actually the construction money. The money that they're building facilities with, that they're investing in that way. Once they've decided that, yes, this looks to be economic and they get their permits, then they start building. The third piece is the value of the minerals. And that value says, okay, we produce this many ounces of gold, this many ounces of silver, this many pounds of copper, this many pounds of zinc, this many pounds of lead, times the average price for the year for those items. So it's not what the industry receives, but it is a measure of the value.
to use your fish analogy, that would be like saying the value of the fish that came out of Alaska is the same thing that's charged for a fillet in the Seattle fish market? Is that a,
yes.
Would that be an apples
yes.
to, or a fish to gold comparison?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
I just want to make sure that I understand the measurements and how it does. And I don't think that's what we do with the value of fish. Is it, Representative Seaton, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. Is that a net smelter return value that they're reporting?
Is that
a net smelter return value that they're
no,
reporting?
No, this is a value defined by taking the amount of metal that's produced by the average world price. Okay? Nothing to do with NSR, nothing to do with that.
Okay. So I just, clarification. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, you just kind of were hitting on where I was going. I was more added value for Alaska's products. Now with the rail spur that's going to be coming into Port McKenzie, we'd be able to take ore and other materials to be developing cement or concrete or gypsum board out of the Fairbanks area. And that's a lot of added value, I think, that we're missing the boat on right now, quite literally, where we have a lot of container ships leaving Alaska empty, where we need to be having them full. Can you talk a little bit about the expansion or possible expansions of those type of industries in the state?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Newman, the extension of that railroad to Port McKenzie is great. That is a very important piece. And let me say, I think it's in the immediate term, it's more important for the wood chips and such as that can come out of the interior. Because the timing to get minerals on that railroad is significant. The timing to get an ore deposit, I mean, we're talking, 10 to 15 years or more, and so the railroad needs to be up and running, and then people can look at it and they say, I know what my economics are going to be now because that railroad's in place, and okay, then we can do it. But at this point, nobody assumes that railroad is going to be there, and so it's a huge benefit, I believe, for all of Alaska and the interior in particular.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question, and I can't remember where this was at, but I think it was around Delta, but it's somewhere where the mine was going to be close to the road. I know every mining operations, their cost of energy is different, but in those situations where they are close to a road or something like that, they can actually operate with the minerals being at a lower grade or something like that because they don't have the bigger expense of possibly having energy that's run with diesel or something like that.
Mr. Chairman, Madam, each project is significantly different. Okay, in general, what you said, I would concur with. Infrastructure in Alaska is part of the reason that, in many cases, a lot of companies haven't looked here. I was at a conference in Vancouver in January, and speaker after speaker from projects in British Columbia, in particular, would look at the map and they'd say, and by the way, we're only 15 kilometers from this highway, and within 40 kilometers we have three communities, and over and over they're reiterating the extent of the infrastructure that they have in British Columbia. And I'm going and I say, oh my goodness, wouldn't we love to have that? And that's why I made the comment regarding the Livengood project. That particular project is so close to the road, the probability, I mean, it's a huge factor, the infrastructure requirements. And contrary to, if you will, popular belief, mining almost always pays for its own infrastructure, okay? And I'm told for example, of Red Dog. Well, yes, Ada made the investment, but Cominco made the commitment that they would pay a certain amount per year, no matter if they operated or not. So yes, it's the state of Alaska and through Ada invested and built the DeLong Mountain Transportation System, but the company guaranteed payment of that amount, and I think it's over $250 million that Cominco has now paid for use of that facility, way, way more than, it's probably one of the best investments that Ada ever made.
Representative Edgman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've really enjoyed this presentation. This is the second one that I've sat through, and I think we can clearly see the economic benefit that the mining industry really plays throughout the entire state, and certainly throughout rural Alaska, where we desperately need jobs and we need some kind of a industry presence and so forth. But the one issue that has been touched upon here today, and I think it's looming on the horizon, at least in my opinion, is the fact that if we do move in this era where large-scale mining is more prevalent, and we do get to that 55 number where we've got large-scale mines sort of scattered all around the state, we are going to have environmental issues that are going to crop up with mines. We're going to have water quality issues that crop up. We're going to enter into this era where the whole climate is different than what it is today. I guess what I'm trying to say is that mining reform is on the horizon here in Alaska at some point. And when I say reform, I don't mean to take the mining industry and to do what these clean water initiatives purport to do, if in fact that's what they do, which is to shut down the industry, because I think that would be blatantly unfair and unwarranted. But reform in the sense that the laws and the bonding reclamation, the taxation regime, all that stuff catches up to where the industry is in terms of its development and exploration in Alaska, sort of online with the 30 days that we spent with the oil industry last fall here in the halls of the Capitol here. So having said all that, you may disagree with that point, but I guess two questions. Number one, is mining reform on the horizon from the association perspective? And if it is the association going to be a willing player to make sure it's done so that the investment climate and the regulatory climate is fair to the industry as well as fair to the state and its interests?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Edgman, we're going to be involved, okay? We're going to be at the table. I mean, whatever it takes place, we're going to be there. And your question was, I need to divide it into each piece, look at each piece of it. You're correct. I would disagree with part of where you're coming from. We have today what I will call a very progressive taxation policy, and again, remember, we only have five mines, only two of which are on state land. But an example that I like to give is Greens Creek in 1993 shut down. They reopened about 18 months later. If there had been a different tax regime in place instead of a net tax, Greens Creek, I can guarantee you, would have shut down sooner, and those people would have lost their jobs sooner, and it would have been shut down for a longer period of time later. And it's a fact that during that shutdown period, Kennecott and Hecla looked strongly at whether or not they should even reopen the mine at all. And if they did a significant amount of additional underground drilling during those 18 months, and they discovered the Southwest ore deposit, which was significantly deeper, and they made the decision. And thank goodness they did, because they could have reclaimed that mine. They could have shut that mine down in mid-1990s, but they didn't. They kept at it. If there had been a different kind of a tax regime in place, a gross tax, for example, an NSR, which is a gross tax, if that had been in place, we may not have Greens Creek today. And the city and borough of Juneau may not have its largest taxpayer today. So we need to look at every single one of those pieces very, very carefully if somebody's going to propose changing those. Because we have a tax regime in place. We have one that we have many, many companies that have looked at. They've watched Alaska. They've said, hey, the mineral industry has a a secure in-place permitting system and taxation system in place. And, I mean, the state does right at this point, and they've been here investing because of that. and to now pull the rug out from under them, I think the legislature would be wise to consider that very, very carefully before they did something like that.
Can I ask a second question? Unrelated to the first question, maybe a little less controversial, the issue of energy, and I had a good discussion with Stan Foos and some others about the Donlin and the challenge of providing energy to that project alone, 120 megawatts, I think it was, that was described to me. And certainly if you look at some of these other projects around the state, tremendous amount of energy requirements. I spoke with Barrick Gold, Michael Brown, this morning about how it's a challenge worldwide to get energy sources, and how Barrick, I think, produced the first wind turbine renewable energy source at some development site in Nevada, I think, something like to the extent. But your comments on the challenge of meeting the energy for the industry in order for it to continue throughout Alaska, and certainly the energy challenge that we're all facing right now, just as consumers and utilities and so forth. But what's the industry doing in the face of some of these challenges of providing the adequate energy it needs to get to the development stage?
Through the chair, Mr. Regman, that company in particular, Barrick, has been looking at potential that wind generation would be a part of their power mix out there. And companies are doing that everywhere. Companies are looking at the possibility of nuclear. The city of Galena has done has, I mean, a lot of people are following that carefully. Whether or not that probably doesn't meet the time frame of the projects we're looking at, because they don't yet have the process approved by the FERC commission. They don't have one up and running right now, and so the timing for those things are way off in the distance. But companies are scrambling, looking for every possible alternative. I mean, you name it. If it's a possibility to generate energy. A real significant advantage that the Cook Inlet Basin has right now is for use of the coal and the sequestering of the carbon dioxide and using it to then pressurize the structures for oil, further oil recovery. It looks, and at the same time, so you gasify the coal, you need a power plant for the agrium to go with the agrium plant. They would then have a feedstock for their products, and there would be a power plant there that would have excess capacity, so that can help provide some of the power, and which of course is right on the grid, and then the carbon dioxide that's left over afterwards can be put down in the Cook Inlet Basin. To me, it's a win-win-win. Whether or not that can go forward, we'll see.
And Representative Edgman, I think one of the key points that Steve brought up is that in a lot of cases, in most cases, that the mining industry pays for its own infrastructure. So I'm looking at high lines to some of these mines that we can feed some of the rural communities and take some of the pressure off for the diesel generation. So I see and I hate to quote a former governor, but roads to resources. I kind of like high lines to resources. I think having power generation someplace that we could ship out and feed the communities as well as the industry. And I think we're looking at some stuff like that in a bill and on the task force that you and I have talked about and with Representative Faircloth. Along those lines, Steve, is there any way you could get me the total consumption of power for the mining industry?
Mr. Chairman, I'll give a shot at it. Yeah. Sure.
I'd like to know what we're looking at out there and capabilities and stuff that we would need to be able to generate to fulfill my blue sky vision. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know whether it's Steve or Jim to answer this, but and you might have mentioned it because I didn't get here quite at the very beginning, so it might have been mentioned. But in Alaska, to get the permits and what our environmental regulations are and everything, are they stronger in Alaska or tighter than they are in other states? Or how do we compare with other states as far as that goes?
Mr. Chairman, I'll divert to Carl. He spent, 5 years of his life doing that for POGO, so.
Yeah, the A significant factor is that the umbrella over all the permitting processes is the federal NEPA process, or National Environmental Pollution Control Act. And so, but within that umbrella, then, the state has developed its own permitting process. And the rigor that comes in third-party technical review and the scientific analysis is then managed together with that federal process and the state process. So I think it's so the kind of the rigor that's applied is provided by a federal umbrella, and where the state can provide the opportunity for coordination of the state process and the federal process, which is where the state of Alaska has a pretty good process in that regard, in terms of while still being rigorous, it coordinates between the federal and state agencies to minimize duplication and to improve communication on the technical side, so that you can actually advance through the process. So certainly Alaska's process is strong, and we experienced in that directly, but it also, we demonstrated that it's a viable process, that you can work through the technical issues if your project can demonstrate you can meet the standards.
Any other questions for from the members? Representative Roses.
Just one. I wanted to go back a little bit to the statement that was made about Red Dog Mine was in the process of planning to drill for natural gas. Could you give me a little bit more information on that,
Carl?
Just related to the geology in the area, there's potential for a shale gas. The geologic formations are not very conducive to producing gas, but we know it's there and it's worth a test. And there is an ongoing program underway to kind of test the viability of developing the gas that's known to be in the shale in that surrounding area.
Do you have any kind of an estimate as to how much of a quantity we're talking about?
Well, that's what the test is trying to determine. That. No, it's just speculative at this point, in terms of knowing that the gas is present, but can it be produced in what quantity, and what is the continuity in terms of geologically between the different boreholes. And so it's still way preliminary.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I find that one kind of interesting, because it certainly would have a tremendous economic impact on the communities that are in that area, if indeed that came to fruition and there was enough reserve there to not only supply the mine's needs, but also to be able to supply the community. It just changed the cost of energy in those communities significantly.
And Representative Rose, I think, if I'm not, I don't want to speak out of time, but I think that's, you're probably looking at doing a gas turbine and generating power for the mine's use itself. Is that kind of the reason for the exploration? And
certainly, that's the objective.
And I would assume that I don't want to assume anything, but this, any additional generated power could then be, you know, sold to the surrounding communities, or
there is that possibility, as well as if the technology is demonstrated kind of in that geologic terrain, there may be other opportunities in the region.
Any additional questions? I'd like to thank everyone for attending today. It's been very enlightening. I appreciate it. With that, hearing no questions, we will adjourn, and it is around 1:25.